Last time we talked about the question of how you do Haggalah on a pot if it's the largest pot you have, so you can't put it into another pot. And we came up with a strategy. The Gemara's strategy was that you make a lip around the rim of the pot made of dough, or as the Shulchan Aruch said, if you're kashering for Pesach, use clay instead, and that will allow for water to gather within that lip along the rim of the pot, and that way you'll kosher the pot from any splashing that it did onto the rim. So Jared, I think it was Jared, asked the question last time that, you know, How does this make sense? Meaning, didn't their pots overflow, right? Like our pots overflow, such that they could have just overflowed the pot in order to kosher it, and who needs a lip at all? So I looked into this a little bit, and I think that overflowing would not have been necessary, because any overflow that you had was something that was an unusual, occasional occurrence. It wasn't part of the cooking process. It may occasionally happen, but it wasn't built in and it wasn't normal. Keep in mind, as we said last time, they were careful about their water supply. They weren't wasting water. So the so because it was an unusual occurrence, it didn't require koshering. Meaning, we only need to kosher using a level of koshering appropriate for the normal use of the pot. And here I'm going to share with you the source sheet. And you can see there the first two sources on the source sheet are from the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishneh Berurah. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, Kli gadol shenu yachal achniso l'soch kli acher machmas godlo. This is our case. You have a large pot. It's too big to put it into, to submerge it in another pot. Oses safa l'fiv betit, you make a rim, a lip, out of clay. Kadesh yismalei heitei v'yagiu amayim bisfaso, so that it will fill up well, and the water will then be able to reach the rim of the pot. U'malo mayim u'marticho, and you fill it with water, and you boil it up. And then he talks about the stone and so on. And the Mishneh Berurah, commenting on that in source Beis, writes, V'chol zeh b'kli she'ein derech lachniso l'toch kli rishon shel chametz. This assumes that this pot is a pot that you don't normally submerge in a chametz pot that's on the fire. Rak she'mishtamshin v'sochol b'roschen. You just heat up water in it. V'lachein sagi b'takanazu. And that's why this method works. And the key is what he said, ein derech. It's not normally submerged. Aval kli shetashmisho mibachutz, but if you have a utensil that is normally used on the outside is normally exposed to hot water. Kigon, for example, he says, ka'ara shekofin lefamim ala kedera. If you have a plate that doubles as a lid for the pot, so the top of the plate gets hot food on it, and the bottom of the plate is also exposed to hot water from the pot that is covering. O klisha shoven bame akdera, or if you have a cup that you use as a ladle to take out of a hot pot, then ein la takana bofenze, then this method isn't going to work for it. Because the outside has not undergone Haggalah. So the assumption is that if you're talking about a vessel that normally has hot water hit the outside, then what we're talking about isn't going to work. Our case is specifically because it isn't normally exposed to this. So you just do the lip because it gets more routine exposure from the splashing, but that's all that you need to do. The truth is, there is another line in the Mishneh Berurah that I have some difficulty with squaring it with this, but I think overall that that's what's going on in our Gemara. You're not normally overflowing this pot, and therefore there's no need to overflow it to kosher it, and you don't want to overflow it because, again, it wastes water, it can put out the fire, so you just take care of the lip of the pot. Is that clear? Right. Jared's not here this time, so I'll have to pursue the question after he has the recording. Chuck?
I'm unclear. Just to clarify, so even if I know that something inappropriate was on the outside, I don't have to kosher it because normally it doesn't take place.
Correct. The fact that it happened happened once, in and of itself is not a requirement for me to kosher it at that level. Meaning I'm still koshering the pot, but I don't need to worry about the outside if once in a blue moon when I was cooking chametz, something may have splashed on the, you know, there may have been an overflow on the outside. That doesn't mean, to go where you're, I think you're going with this, if I have a pot and at some point something happens to it, I can't say, well, that's not the normal use, therefore no koshering is required. Koshering is required. So if I have a fleishik spoon and once it goes into a dairy pot, yeah, that's going to need koshering. But what we're saying here is that the level of koshering that we use when we kosher something is attuned to the normal function of the pot, not the occasional happenstance event. Okay. So that brings us to the Gemara's final discussion, which is a discussion about knives. And the concern that we have is that the that knives that are used to cut things that are not kosher, principally meat, get grease on them, and because it's a sharp blade, you're not going to clean the grease off of the blade properly. So what we're about to recommend, as explained in the Shulchan Aruch, is in case you want to use a knife that has been used for treif, for something that is kosher and cold, here's what you do. That's what we're about to explain. The Meiri has a different perspective. The Meiri thinks that this is actually meant for sharp-tasting items. The Meiri thinks you don't need to kosher a knife at all. You don't even need to worry about cleaning it unless you're dealing with spicy food or hot food. But that's not the Shulchan Aruch's position. The Shulchan Aruch says what we're about to recommend is necessary if you're planning on using your using your knife for cold food. Clear?
There's another element with knives, right? Which is Duchka the Sakina.
So Duchka the Sakina is on the other end of this, meaning we're on the koshering side of it. Duchka the Sakina is a separate point. It's how the knife absorbs treif. And the fact that normally, let's say I have a spoon, and I put a spoon in cold soup, and then I find out the soup was treif. So it's no big deal. You just rinse off the spoon and you're done, right? That was what we had said actually in our Mishnah. However, when you're dealing with a knife, even if the knife was only used with cold, if it's pressed with force into something that's not kosher, then it can absorb that non-kosher food. And that's what Rabbi Grossman is referring to there. But here we're talking about the other end of things, and it's how to eliminate the non-kosher status. So what we're about to say is, in the event that you're just using the knife with cold food, we don't require serious koshering. What we do require is serious cleaning that's going to remove the grease from the outside of the knife. That's what we're looking for. So the Mishnah had said that if you're dealing with a knife, it said shafa, you're supposed to wipe the outside. Literally, you could take shafa to mean to scrape the outside as opposed to wiping it, and indeed that was what Rashi said. Rashi's position was that you wipe the knife with a rough wool in order to remove the grease. So I'm going to share the Gemara. Did anybody else want to comment on that before I share the Gemara?
I just want to clarify, when you're talking about using a knife that was previously used for non-kosher, do you know how it was used? Like, does it matter how it was used for non-kosher? Like, you just happened to come across a knife and you know that it was used for non-kosher. Like, but you have no idea if it was used for something sharp or not, or do you always assume that it was?
So it doesn't. You assume the worst. What we're talking about, remember how the Gemara got into this discussion. It's very easy to lose focus when you do Gemara once a week. So it's good to think back. The Gemara got into this whole discussion because it was talking about a wine press. Everything starts with wine. If I buy a wine press off of a non-Jew, how do I kosher the wine press? And once we did that, we started talking about how you kosher other things that you bought off of someone who wasn't Jewish. So I don't know what he did with this knife. For all I know, he kept kosher. But my assumption is indeed the worst, that this was used without an out treif. So, the sharing with you the Gemara here. The Mishnah had said, and if you're following along on the page here, or frankly in your own Gemara, it's the sixth line, Hasakin Shafa Vihi Tahora. You scrape the surface of the knife. And again, Rashi said, rough wool, in order to make it Tahor. Tahor doesn't mean Tahor. Tahor means kosher for use. So, Amar Rav Ukva Bar Chama. Rav Ukva Bar Chama said, V'no'atza asara pa'amim bekarka. Now that is a trick. That's already a trick. I believe some people here are using Gemaras that have an English translation. If someone has an English translation, can you tell me, Rav Ukva Bar Chama, how do you translate what he said to do?
My translation reads, says, and one must thrust it 10 times into the ground.
Okay, so that's one way to read it, and that's consistent with Rashi. If you take a look at the Rashi over in the margin where my arrow is pointing, V'no'atza, he says, Af al pi shashafa. Even though you already scraped the surface, you also need to stab it into the ground 10 times. And then he gives you this idea of rubbing it with the wool, with the rough wool. But either way, as Rashi understands it, Rav Ukva Bar Chama is saying, it is insufficient to do what the Mishnah said. The Mishnah says, scrape the surface, but in addition to that, you also need to stab it in the ground 10 times. Clear? That's Rashi. Does anyone have a translation that goes differently?
Rabbi, one, 10 times. I mean, 9, 11, or if it's supposed to be in the ground a certain amount of time, why not just leave it there for a longer time instead of 10 times to do it?
Good. So we're going to come back to that. Both questions are excellent questions. Hang in there. So the Meiri disagrees with Rashi. If you take a look on your source sheet, and I am going to stop sharing the Gemara so I can instead share the source sheet. The Meiri here, for some reason I skipped the number on him, but it's where the arrow is here, Beis HaBechira, etc. He says, U'le'inyan lachtoch botzonein hacharif. If you want to cut sharp, cold food, because again, he thinks we're talking about sharp food in the Gemara, not just general food. Kigon, for example, snon, a radish, the esrog, or an esrog. We're going to have to come back to why he mentions esrog here. V'domehen, and the like. Tsarach shifa, you have to scrape it. V'hi hashchaza b'mashchezes obereichayim shel napachim. This is sharpening it. Like with a sharpener or with a millstone that the smiths use. And then the word that I underlined and bolded, oh, alternatively, she'no'atza eser pa'amim bakarka, that you stab it into the ground 10 times. He thinks that what Rav Ukva Bar Chama is doing is he's saying, you don't have to scrape it, just stab it in the ground. They both accomplish the same thing. And he continues to say, u'gedolei harabonim. When the Meiri writes Gedolei HaRabbanim, he means Rashi. The Meiri has codes for the various great figures he's quoting and referring to. Gedolei HaRabbanim means Rashi. So he says, Rashi, Hitzricho Eshneim, said you need to have both acts. Both scraping it and stabbing in the ground. Ratzalomar Shifa Uniitza, V'ein Divrayim Nirin. But he says, I don't think that's correct. I don't think that's right. And he says, I'll prove it to you. We didn't get there yet, but the last Gemara on our page, which he's quoting here, is going to talk about a case in which a non-Jew cuts an esrog for a Jew, and all he does beforehand is stab the knife in the ground 10 times. We don't see anything about scraping the surface. So he says, that proves that it's an or. It's not an and. So the position of the Meiri, unlike the position of Rashi, is you only need to do one of these, and that seems to be the view of the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch and Yeredeya Kufchaf Aleph. And I think that the reason why you have this debate is because they don't agree on what shifa is. Because Rashi told you shifa just means you rub it with coarse wool. Whereas the Meiri says shifa was sharpening it. So Rashi says rubbing it with coarse wool, that's not really getting anything off. Therefore, you also need to stab it in the ground. Whereas the Meiri thinks shifa is sharpening it or using a millstone. So as far as he's concerned, that's sufficient. So it's either that or stabbing it in the ground. You follow? I think that's the source for the debate between the two sides. So, stabbing your silverware in the ground, or stabbing your knife specifically in the ground 10 times. So going back towards what Howard just said, and what Eldon emailed me during the week, and what I saw also as a kid in New York, this is where people got the mistaken idea that you kosher silverware by putting it in the ground for a while. So you'll have people who will plant their silverware. It's out of this this Gemara, but it's not at all what our Gemara is talking about. Our Gemara is saying that you're cleaning the silverware by jabbing it into the ground and pulling it out. It's not about it's not about leaving it in the ground. You're not supposed to leave it in the ground. Leaving it in the ground is doing absolutely nothing to help your case. The Gemara then continues to talk about how exactly you do this. So I'm going back to sharing the Gemara. Amar Rav Huna Braid Rav Yoshua, or some have it as Amar Rava, Ubekarka She'ena Avuda. It isn't any ground. You do it in unworked ground, unworked earth. And the idea here of doing it in unworked earth is that there's greater resistance. If it's earth that's already been dug through, then it's just going to go in like sand. You need it to really scrape the surface of the knife. Amar Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana says, "Ubisakin yafa she'ein bagumos." He says it has to be a good knife. Sakin yafa. What does that mean? No pitting in the side of the knife. Why no pitting in the side of the knife?
Maybe on the side of the knife, the shamunas can get stuck in there.
Right, the grease can get stuck in the side. So you don't want that. Tanya Namiachi, and have a brisa supporting this. Sakin yafa she'ein bagumos, if you have a good knife with no holes, noat asar pamin bakarka, stab it into the ground 10 times, that's what you would do. So that's the idea here is this of doing this stabbing. Now I'm going to share with you the source sheet. Going back towards the source sheet, source Gimel, and this goes back to Howard's other question. We talked about length of time. What about number of times? So the Yerushalmi doesn't have 10 times. It says sakin, a knife, tochva baretz shlosha pa'amim v'dayo. He says, Yerushalmi says, you stab it into the ground 3 times, and that's enough already. And Rabbi Ba, also known as Rabbi Abba, says, B'shem Rabbi Yehuda, Hada de itmar besakin kitana, al besakin gedola, tzricha libun, Hada, it is saying itmar, Hada de atmar. That which you are saying is talking about with a small knife, a large knife that's not good enough, you need to actually do libun, to whiten the blade. Why is a large knife different? The Pnei Moshe commentary explains, because sakin gedola yesh besocho pegimos vegumos. A large knife, a long blade, is going to have defects in it. It's going to have pitting, and you need to do libun. That's the idea. Tosfos on our Gemara. So I'm going to go back to sharing the Gemara page again. The top Tosfos, Hasakin Shafa, Vinoatz Asapam Bekarka, quotes you the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi Kamar Shalosh Pam, the Yerushalmi says 3 times. Mashma Dacha Labdavka Asapamim, which makes it sound like when we said 10, we just mean a lot of times. We don't really mean it has to be 10. However, Mil Midikamrina Lekaman Adatsa Asapamim Bekarka, from the fact that we are going to say here 10 times, specifically, Mashma Didavka Ka'amar. It sounds like our Gemara is serious. v'yesh la'achmir. He says you should be strict. It's unclear whether we really mean 10, and therefore we do. We do 10. So I don't know. Just a quick show of hands. Has anyone here ever done this?
My mother too.
Okay, I did it. I did it very early on in my marriage, which has, thank God, survived. The knives not so much. But when we were living in Rhode Island, when I was with my first shul, there was a park there called Blackstone Park. I had traipsed up a knife, or someone, I don't remember, maybe it was me. Had traipsed up a knife, and they went out to Blackstone Park and start stabbing the knife into the ground, and some guy walks up behind me. And asks me, "Do you always find your silverware here?" And I actually thought, you know what? That's better than other things he could have asked me. So I'm just going to say yes. easier that than explaining, and thank God he wasn't asking me where the body was. But this is actually, I will say, a fine way to clean a knife. If your knife survives, if the blade doesn't get bent, it actually really does scrape the surface of the knife, assuming you're using good earth for it. Nonetheless, this is not what kashrus agencies generally do. This is not the norm. And I brought you on the sheet, so I'm going to share that again, from the OU. The OU, source number one in the English sources, in practice, ni'itza, this act of stabbing, is seldomly performed nowadays. Instead, one can clean the knife by immersing it in boiling water, hagala, so they're fine just doing hagala, or by pouring hot soapy water over the knife, thereby melting away the residue. You pour hot soapy water, that's good enough. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky maintains that one may also rub the blade up and down 10 times with steel wool. He posits that this might be even better than ni'itza, because steel wool scrapes the blade. It's similar to rubbing the blade against a sharpening stone, which is an extremely effective method to remove the non-kosher fat from the blade. So that's an option that they give here: hot soapy water or steel wool. I had heard from a mashkiach that bleach could be used. In preparing this shiur, I looked at the CRC's website out of Chicago. And if you take a look at source number 2, they point out the problem with trying to apply stabbing it into the earth to all blades. Not all blades can be stabbed. If we take these halachos at face value, they write, any grinder, chopper, grater, or blades used for cutting non-kosher food in a factory would require ni'itza before it could be used for kosher food. However, in just about every factory situation, ni'itza is impossible for halachic or practical reasons. A grinder and cheese cutting wires are good examples of this issue. Even if the grinder's blades were physically able to be removed from the machinery, they would likely not be suitable for ni'itza on halachic grounds. The wires are not firm enough to be thrust into dirt. It's not going to work. When he says not suitable for ni'itza on halachic grounds, I think he means because the surface isn't a smooth surface. It is generally accepted in the kashrus world that modern methods of cleaning industrial plant equipment via detergents, solvents, and similar methods are so effective at removing residue from equipment that they may be used in cases where ni'itza is required. Therefore, the grinder and cheese wire used in a plant for ambient temperature cheese do not require a hot kashering and may be used for kosher after an industrial cleaning. So they're not actually kashering it in that way. I would add that there's a good reason to use these other methods instead of stabbing it into the ground. We saw way back in the Masechta, I don't even remember how far back it was at this point, we saw a concern when it comes to koshering something by filling it with coals, that you might be afraid to do it fully because you're afraid you're going to break your utensil. The same thing is going to be true when you stab your knife in the ground. You're afraid of breaking the knife, and therefore you may not do it properly. So for that reason, it may be more worthwhile to actually opt for one of these other methods, the steel wool method, the bleach method, that the kashrus agencies are recommending. Okay. Clear?
I'm just thinking, remember, I think Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that you don't do the Itzik because of that, because you might not do it right. The fact that you have to stick it in 10 different spots in the ground.
Yeah.
It has to be firm. So he says you're better off not trying to eat some and just go with
good.
The
okay. Baruch Shech Ivan. Yes.
When you're talking about magic, you're talking about like a chef's knife that has a wooden handle versus a cutlery made of all metal.
So any of these knives would have this problem. Why would you distinguish?
Well, the chef's knife, I can see where the steel rolls.
Right, so the OU is fine with you doing Haggalah. They're okay with you just boiling it up. The assumption here is that people don't want to boil up their silverware. The use of the water, use of the fuel, whatever the reason is, they'd like to avoid that if they can.
Especially if it's silver plated. Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking more of chef's knives where you have a handle that's not metal like that.
Right. Okay, so what we've seen is the recommendation with the knife is either scrape the surface and also stab it in the ground, or it's one or the other, which is the way the Shulchan Aruch seems to take it. But we've given one limitation and said this method of stabbing it is only going to work if the knife does not have holes. If it's not a pitted surface, if it's a clean surface, and then you get, and this brings us to the last piece of our Gemara, the other limitation on where this works, and I already mentioned it when we started the sugya, but now you'll see it in the Gemara itself, and that is, this is only going to be usable if you're dealing with cold, not if you're dealing with hot. So we are now about 12 lines up from the end of the Gemara. Amar Rav Huna Breder of Yeshua. Rav Huna Breder of Yeshua says, Lechol ba tzonein. He says, this is only talking about where what you want to eat is something cold. And again, we had the Meiri cold and spicy, but what he's saying is it's only for something cold. And the rationale, the reason why it's only for something cold, is because this is only a cleaning method. This is not a koshering method. So if I'm only using the knife for cold, non-spicy materials, then I'm okay. But if I use it for spicy stuff such that a taste that's inside the knife could actually be drawn out, if I use it for hot things such that whatever's absorbed in the knife could be drawn out, then all bets are off. But this method will work only when it comes to the issue of using it with something cold. Yes, Ilan.
Sorry.
Oh, okay, you unmuted, so I thought that meant you had a question. Okay, so that's the idea. I will note, and I'm going to share from the source sheet now, so you can see it on your screen, those who don't have the source sheet in front of them. The Rama does not like the idea that you just do this, and you say, well, I'm only going to use my knife for cold things. If you see the Rama here, in parentheses, Ulishtamesh bo bikvius, we're in source Dalet, using the knife in an ongoing way, logara mishar kli, shenogin lahagil afilu tzonein. It's no less than any other utensil where we say that even if you're just using it for cold, we want you to do Haggalah. We don't want a situation in which you're going to just leave it this way, because having a knife around that can only be used for certain things and not for other things is going to lead to problems. So the Rama says, don't leave that around. Okay. Are we clear so far? We're good? Okay. So going back to the Gemara, let's see the last story here. Here we go. He says, it's good for eating something cold. Kihadam demar Yehuda ubati bar tuvi. As the following happened with Mar Yehuda and Bati bar tuvi. Bati bar tuvi is known to us from a Gemara in Kiddushin. He was an Eved who at one point was freed. But there's a whole story involving his being freed. But we'll keep that lineage in mind. Rav Yehuda, or Mar Yehuda, as he's put here, and Bati Bar Tuvi, Habu Yasvi Kamei de Shabur Malka. They're sitting in front of Shabur Malka. Shabur Malka was a Persian prince. You may be familiar with the fact that the Gemara sometimes nicknames Shmuel Shabur Malka, because everything Shmuel ruled on financial issues, the halacha follows him, the way that it always follows Shabur Malka in the secular regime. So they're sitting there in front of Shabur Malka. They have an audience with this Persian prince. Aisu lekamayu esroga. An esrog was brought before them. Not for use on Sukkos, but for eating. You may recall, we had that Gemara ages ago, in which we talked about a non-Jew who dropped an esrog into a barrel of wine, and he reached into the wine in order to get the esrog. And we asked, what was a non-Jew doing with an esrog? And we looked it up and found that esrogim were actually considered luxuries back in the day. So that's what we're talking about here. Was that the esrog was a luxury? So the Persian prince honors them by bringing out an esrog. Pasak achal, he cuts the esrog and bites in and eats. Pasak vahavle labati bartuvi, and then he cuts the esrog and gives some to Bati Bartuvi. Hadar datsa asara zimni biara. This is what Tosfos had quoted. He stabbed the knife 10 times into the ground, and then pasak havle lamar Yehuda, and he cut more of the esrog and gave to Mar Yehuda. So amale Bati Bartuvi. Bati Bartuvi says to him, "Vahu gavra la bar Yisrael." Who? He says, "What? Am I not a Jew? Why did you do that to me? For me you gave me from the treif knife, and for him you give him from the kosher knife." So Amale, to which he replied, Mar Kimli Bigave, Umar Lo Kimli Bigave. First answer he gives is, Rav Yehuda, I know him. I know he's really careful, and therefore I kashered the knife first. You, I don't really know you. I just gave you without cleaning the knife. Ika de Amri, alternatively, Amarle, he said to him, Itker my Abdis Beurta, remember what you did last night. Not a very delicate way to remind him that he's not on the level of Rav Yehuda. Rashi explains, Derech Persiim Limsor Nashim Lach Sanoim. The Persian way was to make their guests comfortable by sending them women at night in their rooms. And Ukshashigra Lahem Balayla Sha'avar Kibel Bati Rav Yehuda Lo Kibel. So Bati had accepted and Rav Yehuda had not. So he says, now you're worried about the kashrus of the knife? That's the least of your problems. That's what Rashi says went on. Tosfos here, which I just scrolled down to, Itgar Mada Abdis Beurta, says, Vinira Delo Chata Baze. He says, don't think bad things about Bati Bartuvi. He was not sinning. Shadayin Haya Evid Ktas. He still had partial slave status because he didn't have the document freeing him yet. He didn't have the Get Shichrur yet. So that's why he was okay doing what he did. But he says, if that was okay for you, then presumably the knife is really not a concern. So then actually, sorry.
Doesn't that make it work? Is he a chatzi eved, chatzi ben charid?
He's not chatzi eved, chatzi ben charid. He's fully eved. Yeah. No, he's fully in. If again, an eved is mu'ukav get shechur is an eved. He's missing his document. He's a full eved. Half and half only happens in the event that there were two owners and one of them freed his half. Yeah. There's no such thing otherwise as half eved. So that's the story there. So the Meiri, which I mentioned to you before, says the idea here was that the esrog was a davar harif, right? The esrog was something that is sharp tasting. And therefore, you needed to do the 10 times in order to remove whatever absorption was in there to such an extent that the charif would no longer be a problem, that sharp taste that was in it would no longer be a problem. And that's brought in the Torah, and it's also brought in the Shulchan Aruch. I'll show you on the source sheet. The OU has the following situation. You can tell by reading the link at the top of number three. This is a question of, my coworker is not Jewish and doesn't keep kosher. May I borrow my coworker's knife to slice an onion? That's the question. So the OU says, this is from their daily emails, in a previous halacha yomis, a previous daily law, we noted that one may not use a non-kosher knife to cut food, even if cold, until the knife undergoes a special cleaning process called ne'itza. We also mentioned that according to some poskim, this can be accomplished by rubbing the blade with steel wool. Is this cleaning procedure also sufficient to allow cutting a sharp food such as an onion? So he says, this goes back to the question of how to read our Gemara. I'm going to just digest it rather than go through the whole thing, but the Shulchan Aruch follows the view that the Meiri takes as well, that the Esrog was considered a sharp food, and yet the stabbing 10 times was sufficient for it, and therefore that works. The OU does note another view, the view of the Bechor Shor, who disagrees and says that no, that it isn't, the Esrog is not considered a sharp food, and therefore you can't prove anything from our Gemara, and you'd have to kosher the knife before you could use it to cut an onion. So this is a very practical question. I had somebody ask me the question just 2 days ago. They're going to relatives, and there's a conversion in the family, and so the relatives they're going to are not Jewish, and the question arises about using their knife and what you can use it for, and what if they want to make a salad and cut a piece of garlic. That comes down to this discussion here that we're having. According to the Meiri's read that the Esrog is sharp, and this is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, the stabbing method, or the steel wool method, or the bleach method is going to be sufficient in order to be able to use it. So that actually concludes the Gemara. I didn't expect us to get that far today, but apparently we did. So yeshua koach to everybody who was there from the beginning of the Masechta. I joined in on Tezvav, Tezayin or so, lo those many years ago. But Shkoyach, we will save Divrei Torah for the Siyum, though, for when we do the Siyum. And Brian, I'm leaving all Siyum-related issues, I think, in your capable hands. For however you want to deal with it.
Yeah, I.